Hello, this is Jerry DiPiano, and you are tuned in to the Love Mia Vita podcast. Today, I'm with my co-host, Dr. Catherine Sharif, and our guest, Dr. Cuckoo Chowdhury. Welcome to the Love Mia Vita podcast, Catherine and Cuckoo. And today, our podcast is entitled, When the Going Gets Tough, : Constipation. So let's begin, ladies.
Okay, well, thanks, Jerry. I'd like to introduce Dr. Cuckoo Chowdhury, who is a gastroenterologist. She's a professor of medicine at Thomas Jefferson University in the Division of Gastroenterology, where she actually holds an endowed chair. She has many positions and most recently became a fellow of the Philadelphia College of Physicians, which is founded in 1750. And she's here as our guest today to discuss constipation. So constipation affects so many women and many more women than men. And people talk about it, but we don't really understand it well. And sometimes the only advice people get is to eat more fiber. And well, first of all, I'd like to do is welcome Dr. Chowdhury, and can you define constipation for us?
Thank you, Dr. Sharif. Thank you, Jerry, for having me here. So constipation is a condition in which the person has uncomfortable or infrequent bowel movements. You know, generally, a person is considered to be constipated when bowel movements result in the passage of hard, small amounts of dry stool, usually fewer than three times a week.
Fewer than three times a week. But people really do vary, and it can be normal in the frequency, right?
Absolutely. Any change in bowel habit is very important. So if somebody has already moved their bowels three times a week and they have already always done that and they are not uncomfortable or they don't feel that they have to force or, you know, put extra force, strain, then they will not be considered constipated.
Okay. And is it true? It seems like more women have constipation than men, but is it true?
Yes, I think it's absolutely true. Women are more likely to be constipated than men. And women, in fact, are more constipated than men are.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, there are many causes. One of them is, you know, women's colon is 10 centimeters on an average longer than that of male colon of the same size. So that means that the stool has passed has to pass to 10 centimeters extra. So that's one reason. Mm-hmm. Second is women also tend to have what is called a longer transit time. That means it takes the digested food and subsequently the stool longer to pass through the intestines and the colon. The third very important reason is the hormonal fluctuation, whether it be during the menses, whether it be during pregnancy, whether it be right after childbirth, or whether it be in the postmenopausal period, women undergo a lot of fluctuations in their hormones. And one of the female hormones that is called progesterone, which sort of slows everything, does predispose the woman to constipation.
So would that explain why sometimes before their menstrual period, women will have constipation, and then when they start bleeding, they may have the opposite?
Absolutely. Because as you know, you probably know, just before the menstrual bleeding begins, the progesterone is at the highest level. And the progesterone, which is a female hormone, slows things down and causes constipation. So right before the onset of bleeding, women are constipated. As the progesterone level falls down, and the woman starts to menstruate, they have diarrhea along with their periods. You are absolutely right.
Okay, that makes sense. And, you know, women pay very close attention to their periods, and they're always curious about that. What do you think is the biggest thing that we don't understand about constipation, either as non-physicians, Well, let's say, what are the greatest misconceptions about constipation?
Yeah, I mean, there are quite a few. Well, one thing that I have seen over the last few years as I was being trained and since I have been in practice is some people think that the answer to all constipation is fiber. Mm-hmm. And that is not true. Because in fact, there are certain kinds of constipation, one of which is called slow transit constipation, which can be worsened by fiber. So a typical example I give often to my fellows or residents when we are discussing things is a typical patient is a young lady who went to the doctor because of constipation, was asked to eat fiber. She went home, took fiber, got bloated, felt the constipation was worse, said, forget it, I'm not going anywhere. And she tried to do her own thing. And then as she gets older, she comes again after several years for a second opinion. Okay. So fiber is not the solution to all constipation.
That's really good to know. Okay. And are there conditions that may cause this slow transit?
Yeah, so, you know, there are, you know, different kinds of constipation. Not all constipation is the same. So when we talk about slow transit constipation, which I often explain to my patients, is called, I tell them it's a lazy colon, and the severe form of that is called colonic inertia. So there are different reasons, but what the commonest reason is, there are certain cells in the wall of the colon called the cells of Cajal, spelt as C-A-J-A-L. And what happens if we don't have enough cells of Cajal, or if these are not present in adequate amount, the propulsive force, the force that pushes the colon or helps colon in the peristalsis, is slow or weaker, leading to slow transit constipation.
Wow. Okay. So people often talk about irritable bowel. Is that the same thing as constipation?
That's a very good question. You know, as you know, irritable bowel itself can be of different kinds. There can be a diarrhea predominant irritable bowel. Mm-hmm. There can be a constipation predominant irritable bowel. And then there is a mixed kind of irritable bowel. Now, when we look at irritable bowel syndrome and chronic constipation, which is associated with IBS, the main difference is in irritable bowel syndrome, the person has pain. The first thing that will come out of your patient's mouth is, I have abdominal discomfort and bloating. In chronic constipation, the first thing that will come out of your patient's mouth is, I cannot move my bowels regularly. And when you ask them about pain, they'll say, well, it's not pain, but it is discomfort when I haven't gone for a while. So pain, if there was one thing that differentiates the two, it's pain.
To what degree does mood play into something like irritable bowel syndrome? Because we've seen the advent of pharmacology that is often recommended for individuals with irritable bowel syndrome. So the curiosity is, to what degree does mood play in IBS?
Call it mood, stress, anxiety. You know, as we all know, they play a role in every single disease or problem that humans have. Definitely in irritable bowel syndrome, and for that matter, in constipation itself, mood does play a role. Mood does play. Some people, when they get anxious, they have diarrhea. That means just before a big talk, some have this nausea feeling, a queasy feeling followed by a bowel movement. So yes, mood does play a role.
And in constipation, it could play the same, have the same type of impact, no pun intended?
Yes, it can. Stress, plus stress and anxiety often leads to a person eating foods that are not always rich in fiber, or they're not always healthy. And when you have foods that are not healthy, the microbes in your colon and in your small intestine are different. And these microbes are often those that don't help you have a normal bowel movement. So the answer to your question is yes, it does play a role.
So if someone has constipation, and how would you suggest that they start to address it? Do they need to go to a gastroenterologist right away?
Well, I think they can start with their primary care doctors because they are excellent in managing constipation, treating constipation at various levels. So I think the most important thing I want to know from my patient is that constipation new or has that always been the case? Meaning, because if it is new, which would be called in medical jargon a change in bowel habits, that has a whole different series of things. Now, say they've had the constipation for a long time, then what I want to think in my mind is this a constipation which is mild, meaning the person moves their bowels every day or every other day, but they have to strain just a little bit? Or is it something that they don't move sometimes for a week and they don't realize it till at the end of the week they feel, wow, I haven't moved my bowels. Mm-hmm. So that would be a slow transit constipation. Or is it something that they feel they go to the bathroom, the stool is sort of in the rectum, but they're having difficulty pushing the stool out, which would make me think of pelvic floor disorder. So those are the things that go in our mind. And as long as it is not a new onset constipation, it is not associated with alarm things like bleeding, weight loss, or a family history of colon cancer, and the patient is above the age of screening and has never had a colonoscopy, they can be. The first treatment can absolutely be done by their primary care doctor.
Okay. So back to, you mentioned the pelvic floor, and number of women have pelvic floor dysfunction, and we hear that it contributes to many different problems. Among them, we think about overactive bladder, but we don't often talk about constipation or gastroenterology as it impacts the pelvic floor, I should say, as the pelvic floor impacts things like constipation and or fecal incontinence. So perhaps you could spend a couple minutes describing how the pelvic floor can impact that, particularly when we hear this from women who have had vaginal births and perhaps a traumatic vaginal delivery where there were many episiotomy incisions, etc.
Yes, a very sort of interesting topic, a topic very near and dear to my heart. So there are various different ways. So as you correctly said, pelvic floor disorders are commoner in women who have had a few vaginal deliveries. But you can very often see it in women who've had just one vaginal delivery. One vaginal delivery. So what are the different things that can go wrong? One is let me start with the simplest. The pelvic floor muscles become weaker as we all grow a little older. The reason it is commoner in women because they have been stretched, for lack of a better word, during pregnancy. So that's one reason. So when we are relatively young, we don't realize the pelvic floor muscle sort of compensates and then we are able to excrete the stool. As we grow older, they're not as strong and we have to put extra pressure or be conscious. That's one. The second thing is episiotomy, or say there has been a damage to the anal sphincter during childbirth. So that can often lead to fecal incontinence. Once again, when the woman is young and the pelvic floor muscles are stronger, they are able to squeeze those pelvic floor muscles. And say they have the urgency, they're able to hold it until they have access to the bathroom. But as they get a little older, because the pelvic floor muscles are not as strong, they're not able to hold it, and they might have their first fecal incontinence in their 60s. In fact, the book says in 50s and 60s. And when you tell them this could be from your episiotomy or prolonged labor, they're like, what do you mean? My baby is 40 years old. And I was just having, I say, yes, you're absolutely right. Your baby is 40 years old, but now the pelvic floor is not as strong. The other thing that can happen is one can develop what is called a rectocele. Rectocele, I can simply explain it as like a rectal prolapse, which is sort of on the inside. And that can happen from prolonged pushing during prolonged labor. So what happens in those cases? It's very common for women who've had a few vaginal deliveries to have rectocele. Does not mean that's the problem. But those patients will come and tell you that the more I push, I feel the stool is right in my rectum, but I cannot push it out. And if you explore or dig further, they'll say, you know what? I have to push sometimes from my vaginal area. So what they're essentially doing is putting mechanical pressure, emptying the rectocele so that the stool comes out. And if that is a problem, then we need to get the appropriate test done for that. Because large rectoceles that are giving rise to symptoms need to be surgically corrected.
Wow. So that's not a pelvic floor. That's not something that a pelvic floor physical therapist can address.
A rectocele, a large rectocele that is symptomatic, cannot be corrected completely by a pelvic floor physical therapist. A small rectocele, because rectocele surgeries are not the most fun. So if there are small rectoceles, you can prevent them from getting larger by doing pelvic floor physical therapy.
Good to know. Thank you.
Wow. That's intense. But it makes sense about a rectocele. I mean, if you look at the pelvic floor, you have your bladder in the front, rectum in the back, vagina in the middle. And so if there's this outpouching of the rectum with stool building up, and if you put your finger in your vagina, you're able to push that out. That is intense.
Yeah.
Well, do women tend to get more constipated or less constipated during pregnancy?
During pregnancy, most, if not all, will get more constipated. In fact, when they come to see us for reflux during the first trimester, I finish that and I quickly talk to them about the pregnancy, the constipation, which I think is going to follow. And again, you know, as you can imagine, it is because of the female hormones.
Yes.
You know, the hormones not only slow down the colon, they slow down the stomach.
Yeah.
You know, causing some gastroparesis, so they get some nausea. They slow down the small intestine. And that slowness is also responsible to some extent for the reflux that they get during the first trimester. So yes, pregnancy is definitely commoner during, constipation is definitely commoner during pregnancy.
Right. And what do you think, in terms of the medical world, what do we need to learn more about constipation? Do we understand everything about it yet?
I think we do understand a little bit more than we did many years ago. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like many other things in medicine, there's a lot more to be learned. Mm-hmm. But a few things that we definitely need to keep in mind, according to me, are not all constipation is sane. The cause of constipation of the person sitting in front of you depends upon their gender, their parity, the medications they're taking, their lifestyle.
You mean parity, you mean how many times they've been pregnant?
How many times they've had children, right?
Yeah, had children, yes. Okay.
And have they started any new medications?
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of things it depends upon. And we should also keep in mind that if you have a person who has a relatively healthy diet, exercises as they should, are drinking, you know, 6 to 8 glasses of water and still not moving their bowels more than once a week, then pushing the fiber or making them drink 20 glasses of water is not going to help. Because all that 20 glasses of water is going to do is make them urinate.
Oh.
So feel bloated. So and in those patients, we should think, maybe she has slow transit constipation or right. Something that is not fixed by diet.
Right. And do you have any favorite fiber supplements for constipation, and do you have any that we should really stay away from?
So, you know, I As far as favorite, I'll come to that. I don't think I have one. However, I do feel that instead of taking the powder, no matter which one it is, whether it be the psyllium husk or the Metamucil or whichever, Citricel, those thicken up in the liquid, and some patients don't like it. It's not very palatable. Many of the fibers are now available in the form of gummy bears or even in the form of wafers. So my favorite for a long time has become just take the wafer, start with one wafer, cup of water, and start the fiber slow. Don't try to eat a whole bunch of salad, 3 fiber cookies, and expect that you'll have a bowel movement.
Right.
So start slow, drink adequate water, and eat something that is palatable in terms of fiber. Because if something thickens up, you're going to do it 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, and the 5th day you'll be like, well, I'm not sure I'm going to eat that.
So we mentioned the fiber, and we think about other things that we, as we age, particularly as we start to mature, whether it's perimenopause, we hit menopause, then we're in postmenopause, and we start to develop these other comorbidities. Maybe allergies show up. Maybe we are using an antidepressant. And we probably ought to talk a little bit about the impact of other types of medications that you're using. I'm thinking about things like antihistamines or anticholinergics as a drug class, which can be drying. And so we probably should talk a little bit about the impact of those on constipation, because let's face it, we all have something. Since that, those are the words of Gilda Radner, there's always something. So maybe you can address that for us.
Yeah, so, you know, that is why a drug history or a medication history is very important, including which medications have been taken for years and which medications started in the last 6 months, especially if the patient says, well, I became constipated 3 months ago. So some of the medicines you already mentioned, antihistamines or either allergy medications, which can cause dryness, definitely. If they are on thyroid medications, which many women in the world are, you need to make sure that TSH, that means the blood level for the thyroid hormone, was checked and it is at an appropriate level. If they are on antidepressants, then was the dose recently increased? Or have they been on the same dose? Or was another antidepressant added? That plays a role. And then as we get a little older, and for those patients that might have, say, for instance, Parkinson's disease, which can happen, and then, you know, the disease itself can cause constipation. Medications used in Parkinson's can cause constipation. That's important. Certain blood pressure medications, like the calcium channel blockers, like the Cardizem, the nifedipines, those can also cause constipation. So there is a whole list of drugs that can, and we need to take a very thorough medication history from our patients.
So in those instances, it would make sense that even if you were concerned about your constipation, until you've really had that assessment done and until you've really ruled out that these were some of the underlying causes, it's possible that talking to your healthcare practitioner, perhaps an adjustment can be made, or at least you could think about strategies that might be different than taking a wafer or one of the other fiber products that you just mentioned, because it may not help.
You are 100% correct. If a medication is cause of the constipation, that definitely needs to be looked into. And in that case, the fiber is not going to help, or it's not going to help permanently. Having said that, let's face it. Once in a while, the patient will say, well, this is the antidepressant that has worked best for me. Do I really need to stop it, doctor? And then if that is working for them, then we need to find a way around that. And that might be depending upon the constipation being mild, something like taking a little fiber or even a probiotic. Or if it is a little bit more on the severe side, then something like Miralax. Because, you know, as you know, we need to treat the whole patient. And everything sort of comes to the bottom line of educating ourselves, educating our patients, educating peers about different medications and their side effects.
Yeah.
So not to trivialize this, but when is constipation a really serious problem? And I'm thinking about what are the complications if you have chronic constipation? Where can that lead? And what should women be concerned about?
So I'll try to answer that in two different parts so that I highlight what I want to. So one, the first part of the question is, when is the constipation a real problem? So the first thing I want to make sure I relay that if the constipation is new onset, it is associated with blood in the stools, it is associated with weight loss, it is associated with loss in appetite, that needs to be taken seriously. So that would be a quick seeing your primary doctor. The primary doctor will very quickly have you see probably a GI specialist. The other part of the question is, when does chronic constipation become a problem? So obviously, chronic constipation becomes a problem because it increases the number of office visits. Several millions of dollars, I don't remember off the top of my head, I spent on over-the-counter laxatives in our country. Forget about the time taken away from work, which I'm not trying to measure for all these office visits. So that itself is a problem. Then it affects the quality of life. Because the patient tells me, you know, often, well, my life is controlled by my bowel movements. That's a very common thing we hear. The third reason it becomes a problem is sometimes chronic constipation can lead to frequent urinary tract infection. That can lead to. So that itself is a problem. As you know, UTIs are commoner in women to begin with, and then you add a chronic constipation. So these are the many things, not to talk about the pain and the side effects of the laxatives that they take, because then they said, well, I took the laxative that you told me and I went to work and I was in the restroom and I was incontinent or I had urgency and I was in a meeting. So I think lifestyle, it affects their quality of life. And that's, I think that itself is a problem.
What about diverticula and the and diverticulitis and diverticulosis? Because we also understand that women may develop diverticula, and that's not an inconsequential issue for men or women, but in particular for a woman.
Yeah, very good question. I almost missed that, so I'm glad you said. So yes, you know, diverticulosis, which as you know are outpouchings in the colon, more common on the left side, but can happen anywhere in the colon, are commoner in the West, as we say. Why? The thought is, the best reason we have is, our diet is not as rich in fiber. We don't have as regular bowel movements as people that don't live in the West do. And therefore, because of increased pressure within the lumen of the colon, these outpouchings develop. Now, the theory is that in order to prevent the outpouchings from getting worse, we need to move their bowels regularly. So that is important. The second problem is when you develop diverticulosis, your colon becomes weak. Because these are all these weaknesses in the colon, it cannot push the stool forward. So it becomes like a cycle. And yes, there is some data that being constipated may predispose you to diverticulitis, which is an inflammation or infection of these pockets in which the person has pain, fever, and all of that. So when we find a person has diverticulosis, there's an extra stress to make sure they move their bowels more regularly than they were before.
So when the going gets tough, we really do need to get going.
And the tough needs to, yes, needs to get going.
Yeah. Can you... If you could just say one thing to all patients that you would want them to know, or the top two or three things about constipation, what should they know?
I think don't be embarrassed to talk to your doctor about constipation, even though you think it is mild. That's number one. If the constipation is new onset, definitely talk to your doctor. Please remember that eating tons and tons of fiber or drinking 20 glasses of water is not always the answer. Although, yes, it is good to eat, drink 6 to 8 glasses of water and eat a 35 gram per day fiber diet, which is what is recommended in us women. And anytime you think your body is telling you something different, see your doctor.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Wow, I learned a lot. And, you know, there are so many different causes. And it's really interesting to me that they couldn't all be solved by fiber, because sometimes I think, well, my patients really aren't trying. But some of them really are, like, really trying to be consistent, conscientious about fiber, and they still can't go. And we really do need to consider over-the-counter medications, and we need to consider other causes like slow transit. It's more complicated than I think we give it credit for.
You're absolutely right. And there's one thing I want to add. It is very important not to ignore the urge to defecate, especially early on in life. It is almost like toilet training that we do for little kids. If one ignores the urge to defecate, it can later on become a problem. When I tell that to medical students, you know, I can see them smiling, but it is true. In the morning, as the book says, clearly coming out of the GI book, put aside an unhurried time that you can spend in the bathroom. And pretty much same. So once you avoid the urge to defecate, the stool is there, the colon is slightly distending, increased pressure, over time, diverticula developing, slower motility. So that's another simple thing we should think of.
So it's okay to bring a book into the bathroom. It could be your Kindle. Could bring your Kindle just to add a little humor to a very difficult, difficult to move topic. We should bring a Kindle into the bathroom, or a book in the bathroom, or a magazine, and sit and relax for a while and do our thing.
I think that's totally fair, except then when you realize that you're in the bathroom for 30 minutes or more, that means there is a pelvic floor problem.
Yeah, indeed. You know, there is one last question that I have, because oftentimes we do resort, when individuals have constipation, they'll go to the pharmacy, they'll pick up some of these products. And then, can people become, I hate to use the word addicted, but can they become too comfortable with the use of laxatives? And is there such a thing as rebound constipation? So you're using a laxative, you develop a tolerance. Is that something? Is that a thing?
So it's a very interesting one. That used to be thought to be a thing. We don't think of it as anymore. In fact, when my patients often ask me, do I have to take this every day, say a prescription medication for constipation, of which there are quite a few safe medications, I tell them, yes, you can. And then I often compare it. I said, you know, if they have hypertension, I said, we take this medicine, right? Now tell me, is the medicine working for you for that, to control your high blood pressure, or are you dependent on that medicine? So that is a difficult thing to answer. We used to think maybe 20, 15 years ago that there was something like dependency. We don't really think that. If the person needs the medicine, they need the medicine.
So we feel that we need something to support us. Maybe it's a laxative, maybe it's fiber, maybe it's a probiotic, maybe it's all of the above. You heard the warning signs. This is something you want to take into consideration. So the bells go off. Get in to see your gastroenterologist, but don't be ashamed to go to a gastroenterologist, even if you don't have some of those alarm bells going off. But it's just really tough to go.
Absolutely. That's what I would say.
Great. Well, Dr. Kuka Chowdhury, Professor of Medicine and Gastroenterology, Endowed Chair at Thomas Jefferson University, thank you so much for joining us today to discuss constipation.
Thank you, Dr. Sharif.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Chowdhury, and for you, Dr. Sharif, Catherine Sharif, as my co-host, for joining me on the Love Mia Vita podcast. I'd like you to encourage all of you that are listening and watching to please visit us on our website at fempharma.com, where you can learn more about topics in women's health. Check out our podcast. And I want to send to you all of the blessings, and especially help you to go, go, go now that you have heard this wonderful podcast. Remember to love Mia Vita.
Bye-bye.